When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hello, listeners. This is Talkist in Europe podcast. This is episode number 35, if I remember correctly. My name is Maciek Makulski, and with me is Adam Reichardt. Hello, Adam.
Hi, Maciek. Hello, listeners. Yes, welcome to Talk Eastern Europe, another episode during the coronavirus lockdown that we are recording from our respective homes, which, as many of our listeners know, is not so unusual for us, since Maciek is based in Warsaw and I'm based in Kraków, so it's great to be here.
Yeah, and our topic for this episode is the future of Eastern Partnership, or maybe even I can say not only one future, but a few futures. But we will reveal what is behind that in a minute. But I would like to start, Adam, from talking a little bit about the New Eastern Europe magazine, which is very important for Talk Eastern Europe, because these two projects are well connected. And very recently, the new issue of New Eastern Europe was published. This is a very interesting one. The one is looking on the war in Donbas, what we have right now in the field. But I know also you have a special message for listeners and for potential, or maybe not only potential, readers of New Eastern Europe. Can you say something about that?
Yes, thanks, Maciek. I do also want to just encourage all of our listeners out there to go to our website at neweasterneurope.eu. Where we do have information on the new issue. It is really one of the better issues that we've published. I mean, I'm biased. All of our issues are great. But this one is specifically focused on looking at the war on Donbass, and particularly the situation on the ground and why it is important not to forget about it. One of the big challenges that we have with this issue is the fact that because of the coronavirus lockdowns in most of the world, and borders are closed, and only essential services are open, the distribution chains and distribution channels for publications like New Eastern Europe are completely blocked. So we are unable to actually distribute this issue for the time being, which is a big challenge for us. Normally, we distribute somewhere around 3,000 copies around the world to different sales points.
And in how many countries do you remember?
It's somewhere around 30 countries, mm-hmm. quite broad. You know, throughout Europe, North America, even in Australia, and a few countries in Asia, as well as South America. But all of that, for the moment, is frozen. And normally, we sell somewhere between 30 to 40% of what we distribute abroad, which is pretty standard for magazine distribution, but in this case, we aren't able to sell any. So we decided to come up with a campaign, which we'll be launching very shortly, to sell as many issues as possible via our website, because we still have our shop open. Our virtual shop is open if we're able to ship it. And in most countries are receiving mail. It's a little slower, but they are receiving mail. So we want to encourage all of our listeners to please support New Eastern Europe. Purchase this issue. I will have the link in the show notes. The cost is 10 euros, and that includes tax and shipping anywhere in the world. And our goal is to sell 350 copies by the end of June. So I think it's a doable goal, something that we can achieve, but we cannot achieve it without the help of all of you out there.
Thank you, Adam. And there will be also a special event, because we can say that New Eastern Europe was always a very digitalized magazine, and it is digitalized, so readers can have an access also to all articles
That's right.
online, but there will be shortly a special event launching on Facebook. Can you reveal something about that?
Sure. We are in the process of finalizing the details of the event, and this podcast will be published well before it, so we can announce it. And that's will be on April 20th. We will have a live discussion with several of the authors from the issue, including Rebecca Harms, who is a former member of European Parliament from the Green Party, very active and very involved in Ukraine throughout her entire career. And so I invite all of you to come join us as well. That'll be live streamed on our Facebook page as well as our YouTube channel. And yeah, Maciek, as you mentioned, if you purchase, I forgot to mention this earlier, but those who purchase the issue online do get access right away to the PDF. So while you're waiting for the hard copy in the mail, you can read the articles all the way already online. And I recorded recently also a tutorial for those who are not sure how it's done. You can also find that on our YouTube channel or our Facebook page.
Okay, so as you said, all important links will be put in the notes of this episode, and maybe this is also a good moment to promote our Facebook group, I mean the Facebook group of Togistan Europe.
Right.
This is a private group, but everyone can join. This is the place where we continue the discussion we have here. And I think we will also put this information about New Eastern Europe and about this special event, live event with Rebecca Harms and other experts. We will put also the link to this event there. So
yes.
Stay tuned for that. And those who are not yet members of the our Facebook group, you can join anytime. Okay, as I mentioned in the beginning, our main topic today is the future or futures of Eastern Partnership, because very recently there was a special report published by Weisgar Insight, a magazine focusing on Central Europe, and this report discusses different scenarios for the Eastern Partnership Initiative. And as I understand, Adam, you did an interview with one of the coordinator and one of the author probably of this report, right?
Yes. I recently caught up with Quincy Clowett, who is the managing editor at Visegrad Insight. And he is, as you said, one of the authors and coordinators of the project. Their report, which is titled Eastern European Futures, Four Scenarios for the Eastern Partnership 2030, is also available at Visegrad Insight's website. So we will, of course, include a link in the show notes. And it's a very interesting report. I really enjoyed reading it because I think it's very clear and provides a lot of good thoughts and discussions and debates on what possible roads the future of the Eastern Partnership countries may take. So I do recommend giving a read to the report. In our interview, we go through all of the scenarios briefly. So I think this interview will give you a chance to understand what's in the report more. But Maciek, maybe before we go into the interview, we should discuss briefly for our listeners out there who are not exactly sure what Eastern Partnership is. We could briefly cover that. I know we've had a couple episodes in the past on Eastern Partnership, but maybe it's good to recount since we have passed 10 years. Last year we celebrated the 10 years of the Eastern Partnership program.
Exactly. Yeah, first of all, I think we need to remind that this is the European Union's initiative. And as you said, last year Eastern Partnership was celebrating 10 years. So it was established in 2009, and maybe not everyone remembers right now, but like a direct cause to establish the Eastern Partnership was the war in Georgia.
That's right.
Or maybe not the war itself, but the situation connected to the war when Russia attacked Georgia, because then many people in the European Union realized that the EU needs to have a complex policy towards the region. And I think this war put a special context to that before, because before that, I think the in most of the EU capitals, it was rather a stronger feeling to have kind of, you know, strategic policy and cooperation with Russia, and it was important change for the European Union that there are also other countries in the region that that the EU should look at and should develop the relations with them.
That's right. That's right. And we should point out that the Eastern Partnership is made up of six of the post-Soviet countries. It's Belarus, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Moldova, Georgia, and Ukraine. Very important countries from our perspective, being in Poland, but also I think from most of Europe perspective in terms of European Union engagement in the region, as Maciek was just saying. And so we can forward 10 years, maybe a little bit into the future, in 2019 and 2020. What is Eastern Partnership look like today? I think a lot has changed and a lot hasn't changed. And there are a lot of concerns which are surrounding the Eastern Partnership for good reason. And then there are a lot of there's some optimism that should be out there as well. Yeah. But I think most important to note is the successes that are tangible for these countries, particularly for the three leading countries, Georgia, Ukraine, and Moldova, which signed association agreements with the European Union. They have established or are establishing free trade zones with the European Union, so economic integration, and of course a visa-free regime, which allows citizens of those countries to come to the European Union without visas. That was quite a big, important success of the Eastern Partnership as well. Yeah. But we can look at a lot of challenges in the project. One I would just point out is the fact that there is a differentiation, which is what they call it, between the three leading countries and then the three countries which do not want such strong engagement with the European Union, which is Belarus, Armenia, and Azerbaijan.
Yeah. So those leading countries, Moldova, Ukraine, and Georgia, I think now we are in this moment that we have different tracks within the Eastern Partnership countries.
Right.
Although the EU still thinks about the Eastern Partnership as the whole group, about six countries. The discussion about successes and failures of Eastern Partnership may go very long, and you are right that maybe we should prepare a special episode about that. But I would like to add to what you said just one more thing that I realized it very recently when the EU published or made a decision that the EU will support also Eastern Partnership countries if the fight with the COVID-19 pandemic and the consequences of this. And I don't know the details how big will be this financial support for them, but I think on even the symbolic meaning of this was that the EU, after these 10 years, like, perceive the six countries as countries that we should also take care about them, and we should remember about them, help them if they need help. So who knows, maybe without the Eastern Partnership there would be no such perspective at the EU level.
Perhaps. I would add, Maciek, the amount that for the moment that they've announced is 140 million euros for support of Eastern Partnership countries in their fight against coronavirus, plus preparing for the economic fallout. And I mentioned this in the previous episode of Talk Eastern Europe, but we at New Eastern Europe, we published an op-ed on our website, which was calling for greater solidarity between the European Union and Eastern Partnership countries, because, as you know, Maciek, their infrastructure, both in the health sector but also economic foundations, are pretty weak, and the crisis that's going to hit after we manage the pandemic is going to be felt much stronger in a lot of these countries. So I do think that it is good that the European Commission announced this support, but there's going to be a lot more needed, and this is an opportunity for the European Union to actually make some big strides in pushing the integration agenda, which the societies in a lot of these countries want, but the authorities in some of them are starting to, you know, to second guess. And of course, there's always the element of the Kremlin, which is pushing for more divisions than integration with Europe.
Yeah, of course, it's not that easy, as we said here. But I agree that was a good thing that happened, and I expect it will be continued. And I think we will also cover this issue here at Talk Eastern Europe in near future.
Yeah, and if there are listeners out there who are interested in what is the current situation in the coronavirus pandemic and the fight against it in the Eastern Partnership countries, we have a special page on New Eastern Europe's website, which is dedicated to Eastern Partnership, because these are countries that are often missed in the mainstream media. So check out our special coverage as well.
Okay, so having said that, let's listen to your interview with Clancy Clowett, in which you discuss the special report on Eastern Partnership and the future of Eastern Partnership.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Joining me now on the podcast is Quincy Clowett, the managing editor of Visegrad Insight and a researcher with the Helsinki Foundation for Human Rights. Welcome, Quincy, to Talk Eastern Europe.
Hello, Adam. It's great to be here.
So today we're going to look at in depth at the recent republished report by Visegrad Insight, which is titled Eastern European Futures Scenarios for the Eastern Partnership 2030, which I found to be really a fascinating report and with some very interesting recommendations. And I'll include a link for our listeners in the notes of the podcast. And I think the report not only provides specific scenarios on a possible outlook for the region of Eastern Europe, but it also highlights the key trends that will impact the future of the region, including security, demographics, politics, and so on. So maybe before we get into the scenarios that are outlined in the report, let's get a little bit of more background on the report. What was the aim for doing it, and who is the audience for the report?
Well, it's not the first time that Visegrad Insight has done a scenario-based report. So basically, for the last couple of years, we've been working together quite often with the German Marshall Fund for the United States in designing these type of scenario-based reports. So in the last 2 years, we've also done a couple on, for example, Central Europe, sketching out some of the scenarios for the next years, but also parliamentary elections, long-term EU budget. So it's sort of a tried and tested recipe, which mm-hmm. we've used before. And it seemed like a very opportune moment with the 10th anniversary of Eastern Partnership, with the Commission having announced last year doing this consultation process and coming up with a new strategy, just in a way to maybe present what we could call a shadow report, in the way where we try to take a bit of a broader perspective, where we don't just take one possible scenario, but try to identify some other developments, what could happen in Eastern Partnership region, but also within the six countries individually in the next couple of years, and then actually to bring about or to encourage a discussion mm-hmm. about policy responses, about how to prepare the countries, but also the Eastern Partnership framework better in response to what possibly could be challenges, but also opportunities.
Interesting. And the main audience that you're looking at to promote the reports to is?
Well, we hope, and we've been already talking to journalists, think tank people, civil society activists, but also in our dissemination events within the six countries, we also try to talk to just people, to citizens who are who are interested in often European integration or Euro-Atlantic integration, that are positive about it as well, that want to discuss possible ways of bringing their country closer to the European Union. So I'd say that those, in the first place, are our audiences. Apart from that, also, well, decision makers, especially also for them to not just to get bogged down a little bit into existing logic of sort of the strategy of program, but also think a bit more broadly about what is the possible direction the Eastern Partnership can take in the next decade.
Yeah, yeah, and I think what I really like also about the report is that it's an easy read. It's not too you know, the language is not too technical, and it's graphically very nice looking as well, and that makes it also easier for, I think, for broad audiences, as you mentioned. What about the methodology for the study? How did you conduct the study itself, and who was involved in the project?
Yes. So as you'll see from the report itself, a lot of people were involved. So Wojciech Przybylski of Visegrad Insight and Jörg Furbrick of GMF were sort of the main editors of the report. But in addition to that, we had lots of extra people, editors, authors also involved. But to go back a couple of steps, actually it all started with a number of workshops we did in the autumn of 2019, where we brought together people from the region, from the six countries, civil society, entrepreneurs, experts, think tank people, also coupled with people from the Visegrad 4 countries who are often working on Eastern Europe, on the Eastern Partnership, in a way bringing them together to have sort of a discussion, first of all, about what is happening in Eastern Partnership, what is happening in the six different countries in terms of what are the trends which we can identify. And then over a number of workshops in different locations, Kiev, Tbilisi, Prague, Warsaw, we try to sort of build upon some of these trends, first by identifying possible triggers, so events or developments that could really throw the region into a different direction, or that could set off a couple of developments. Think about, for example, political succession in one of the countries, or as we see now, for example, a pandemic or a severe economic crisis. These type of triggers, and then to think about sort of logically what could follow out of that. And then, in a way, it became a bit of a mapping exercise. We started putting some of these trends, some of these triggers on a map in terms of what could be the possible impact, but also the likeliness of something like this happening. What you could have, for example, is a high-impact event like a nuclear meltdown, but which is very unlikely to happen, which, of course, is quite a different event from, I would say, like a mild economic crisis, which is much more likely to happen in the next decade even. So those, in a way, were the first steps. So I want to stress here as well that in a way it's not about speculating. What we were trying to do in a way was look at what is happening today, identifying some trends which will continue in the next couple of years, and on the basis of that try to develop trajectories, narrate scenarios based on this information, on this expertise, experience coming from the people who participated in the workshops. And this way we ended up, well, with a lot of information, a lot of inputs, which then took quite a bit of editorial work for our team. And then also with continued input in a way with the participants from the workshops. And then I think also quite significant, and something I want to stress about the report, is that you'll see that there's also country-specific elements there within the scenarios, within the trends, And this is also something that we really worked hard together with some of those participants, some other experts from the region to give that individual perspective. So it's not just scenarios which just generally look at the region, but also try to identify what triggers or what trends are specific for each country.
Yeah, and the result is four of these scenarios, which are outlined in the report. And maybe I can ask you to walk us through a little bit of these scenarios, because I think all of them are quite relevant and quite interesting, and in some sense, in one way or another, are probable. And we'll talk about how they fit also in the ongoing pandemic crisis that we are now facing, which I think overshadows everything that we're looking at. But let's first look at the scenarios that you developed in the reports, and we could start with maybe with scenario number one, which is the pragmatic integration. And in my opinion, it was quite a likely scenario. It still is quite a likely scenario. So, what happens in this scenario?
So, pragmatic integration, I think you rightly point out, does seem a bit like a baseline scenario or something that appears quite likely. Definitely taking into account also the Commission strategy announced last month, that there will be a lot of elements there which will sound familiar. So basically, with pragmatic integration, we were looking for a scenario where essentially, if the present architecture of the Eastern Partnership largely stays in place, most of the policies sort of continue but are a bit expanded, and there's maybe some new emphasis, for example, on green policy, greater resilience, what would happen in the next decade, essentially? So what you see there is, for example, well, more funding, more programs, greater emphasis on connectivity, resilience, especially sort of a closer relationship with those countries such as Georgia, Ukraine, Moldova, which have taken some steps when it comes to economic integration with the EU, to sort of to continue to encourage that, but also to allow a degree of differentiation for the other Eastern Partnership countries, which right. at the moment are sort of less engaged or less willing to engage. So it's quite an interesting scenario because of the familiarity, but at the same time, I think what it shows as well when looking sort of over the next 10 years is that there is a risk attached to differentiation, and it's sort of an open question for the Eastern Partnership in 10 years to what extent it will be able to manage that differentiation between a number of countries which are very eager to integrate more closely with the European Union and a number of countries that may decide not to do that. So that is the first challenge, which comes across strongly from this scenario. The second one is quite closely related to that, is that question of membership perspective, of closer integration. With pragmatic integration, the scenario sort of supposes that the emphasis will be on sort of market, trade, access, connectivity, but absent any sort of political integration or any sort of big symbol which could signify in the future that some of these countries could actually end up joining the European Union. And we're trying to understand within that scenario actually what would be the effect of that. And it seems, or at least if we follow the logic of the scenario, that at some point this might lead to a sense of stagnation within mm-hmm. those countries, that it might not be sufficient just to see some small tangible effects in terms of maybe prosperity, some stability of institutions, whether that might not be enough for these countries to continue their sort of process on the way of reforms, institutions. So in a way, this pragmatic integration or alternatively silent integration can, or at least it appears, it's only sort of a temporary state. Mm. It has to develop into something else. And either it will develop in a sense of stagnation, potentially greater differentiation, which might see actually the end of the framework as it is, or some other outcome, which is maybe closer to the other scenarios.
Right, right. Yeah, and in fact, I think at first glance, this pragmatic integration sounds like it is one of the more optimistic scenarios. But mm-hmm. as you outlined, it really does not do enough to really push in a transformative way the countries to become really integrated with Europe, especially those the ones that want to be. And you do mention this the lack of a membership perspective for mm-hmm. Eastern Partnership exactly. states. In this scenario, I think can have really a dramatic effect in creating this situation where there's stagnation, as you mentioned. And I think you also it ends with noting that. Particularly for the younger generation, it might result either in radicalization of the political scene domestically, or just greater exodus of young people from these countries because they don't see any real progress. It's really slow going in these countries. So that's I think very interesting and something that we really do need to keep in mind when we're looking at how the Eastern Partnership might move forward. But let's look at the second scenario, which is, I think, also one that I, in my opinion, I will have to say up front, I think all of the scenarios has a very strong degree of likelihood. So mm-hmm. I would put them all balanced in some way or another. But this one, I think, is also one that shows what could happen in the case of almost a full pullback or full withdrawal of EU engagement in the region. And this is the one which you called Russian hegemony revisited. Mm-hmm. So let us, maybe explain to us what happens in this scenario.
So essentially in this second scenario of Russian hegemony revisited, we sort of presuppose that there might be a confluence of elements there. First of all, as you pointed out, there is the weakness or at least to some extent the absence of the West European Union. And this would have to be coupled with some sort of a return of Russia on the stage, especially in the eastern neighborhood. What exactly drives that is a bit difficult to say. It might be related to sort of fossil fuels and sort of some greater economic leeway in the next couple of years, which would allow Russia to sort of modernize some of its military capabilities. Or in a way also continue betting on sort of these hard visceral displays of hard power. And if you look at this second scenario, we kind of narrated it a little bit around what could happen, for example, in Belarus, which could be an example of a country that could easily fall victim to Russian pressure, which we already see to some extent today, and what would happen in a scenario where there is an active attempt to have greater control, either over sort of assets within the country, or for example in also in terms of security, and whether that could offset a spread of instability across the region, whether that could lead to further polarization in Moldova, for example, division in Ukraine, and where we see a number of domino blocks actually falling. And as I said, coupled together with the complete absence of the West and also the absence of the EU, incapable or also unwilling to come up with sort of a response or an alternative. And this is something that could be driven, for example, by illiberalism, liberalist tendencies in Central Europe, but also sort of reluctance to engage with the Eastern neighborhood for some countries in Western Europe. It would mean that this creates an opening essentially where Russia can come back on the stage. And then it's interesting to see what the response will also be for the countries from the Eastern Partnership, whether some would eventually have to give in and sort of tolerate again a greater degree of Russian influence, Russian pressure. Whether that might lead also to resistance, that is, of course, harder to say. But as you pointed out at the beginning, there is also a sort of a degree of possibility within this scenario, even though it's a starkly different one from the first one, for example.
Yeah, and I think it's also, from the security point of view, it's something that should be concerning for us who are watching the region and seeing what happens.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh? Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And if there is a reassertion of influence by Russia in the post-Soviet states, the real question is, and I think it's what you outline here, is what would the response be from the EU and from the NATO side? Would it be, you know, just further in disengagement or some level of support or some way to try to stop this from going too far, which would end up basically as the end of the Eastern Partnership as we know it.
Yes, yes.
And so let's go to the next scenario, which is similar but in a different way. And this one is the one that is called the EU pivot to Moscow. So what happens here?
Mm-hmm. So first of all, you'll see that in most of these scenarios, maybe the sort of the position of the EU is not always that great. And I think it shows to some extent some of the limitations of what we have seen, despite the successes of Eastern Partnership. But in the third scenario, EU pivot to Moscow, essentially what we narrate there is a pivot which is driven by the recognition of shared economic and security interests between the EU, between EU member states and Moscow. This could possibly be driven by changes within Russia, change of leadership, maybe some space for sort of a liberal momentum, although that might seem less likely these days.
Yeah.
But what I think is particularly likely, and what we to some extent already see maybe within the EU, within France in particular, I'd say, is maybe the possibility of a common external threat, or at least the emergence of China as being a global power, as being a superpower.
Yes.
Could actually lead to a policy response within the EU and maybe within Russia. That is to some extent harder to say at this moment. Where actually there is a recognition of the need to cooperate together on a more geostrategic level. As a consequence, this would almost automatically lead probably to a downscaling of ambition and engagement for the EU with the six countries of the Eastern Partnership. And then the question is, within the scenario, what actually might happen under such a pivot? Whether Russia might also take advantage of this and leverage this situation or not. I think in any case, the fact of this potential pivot, this sort of focus on sort of more global geostrategic issues will have a negative impact on sort of the pressure the EU puts on the six countries towards reforms, towards strengthening institutions. So that sort of pressure would likely weaken over the next couple of years with, again, sort of a negative impact.
Yeah. And I think this scenario really kind of creates the Eastern Partnership it turns the Eastern Partnership region into becoming like a buffer zone, which is,
yes,
you know, really what we want to avoid. I mean, we're looking at trying to engage and integrate in some way or another these countries into Europe and hope that it has an effect on Russia and that it changes its own attitudes towards the region. But yeah, I also think it was interesting, as you mentioned, that you recognize, and also in other parts of the report as well, is the role that China plays in this region does need to be taken into account in looking at how the geopolitics, economics, and domestic political developments in the region unfold. So I think that was really interesting and very important that you you guys recognize this as well. So that brings us to the last scenario, which I think maybe in some senses we could say is probably the most optimistic, which is called civic emancipation. But at the same time, it could lead to some serious instability. So take us through this final scenario.
Yes, quite right. I think that this scenario will feel slightly different in tone. And it's, I mean, from what I've seen in the workshops as well, and I completely agree that there is sort of most of the scenarios so far are maybe a little bit negative or mostly show negative ones. This one is a bit different. It is in part driven by some of the developments which we've seen in recent years, for example, in Armenia, but also if you go back a little bit longer in Ukraine, other countries. Yeah. And it's driven by the question of what is the prospect of greater civic emancipation? What would happen if people really continue to come on the streets, push towards change within the countries? What actually would happen within sort of these individual countries, but also what would be the consequence for the Eastern Partnership as a region? Probably that would also, or that might in response to sort of the lack of a membership perspective for the European Union. If the realization comes in a way by civil society actors in the Eastern Partnership countries that they have to take control over their own fate, they can no longer sort of rely on Euro-Atlantic integration, on EU integration as sort of a pathway to follow, and they decide sort of to take control of their own fate, and they themselves as sort of bottom-up drive forward reforms. Now the scenario then suggests or narrates in a way that it's quite likely that the EU might be encouraging some of these developments, but it probably would stick to sort of declarative diplomacy. So there would be positive messages concerning sort of civic emancipation, but it might not sort of lead to actual changes in any proposition made with regard to the EU. And probably it would also have to go together with sort of the decline of Russia. So there is no sort of possibility where an external actor like Russia can actually sort of benefit from the upheaval.
Right.
What the scenario sees then is in a way the emergence of new leaders, sort of new a new generation of leaders from civil society, which might mirror a little bit in style Zelensky or Pashinyan in Armenia, hard to say. Mm. But people essentially that are willing to take on a very, very difficult task and that would need to meet very high expectations. And they might be driven by sort of popular support in the initial stages to drive through improvements, reforms, whether that's liberalization, changes in educational sector. But then the key question, and I think here is maybe where the scenario is a little bit ambivalent, is whether they can also sustain some of this power, this initiative coming from the street, and whether these, well, individual Democrats are also capable of creating and sustaining democratic institutions. So the underlying question is there is that whether it's enough, whether civic emancipation is enough in itself, and having those good intentions, but also in a way creating a trajectory, a pathway which is sustainable and can set some of the countries or the Eastern Partnership region on a whole on a different trajectory.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's true. And I think it would be interesting to also, I think a key question here is how strong the systems are in, you know, the current systems that
yes.
If there is this wave of civic emancipation, are these if there would be new leaders, would they be able to transform the system in the way that, you know, as could happen to become more democratic, more open, more transparent, or would it happen that these leaders emerge and then slowly succumb to the existing system, which we've seen in the past in some of these countries take place? And I think also what is interesting with this scenario is, and as you kind of mentioned, that this would require Russia to be somewhat weakened, and there would not be a risk yes. of Russia interfering in a wave of civic upheaval which is requiring, you know, which is calling for more democracy or more democratic institutions, it could actually, if that was not the case, it could actually lead to scenario number two, mm-hmm. where you first have a wave of this civic emancipation, but then you have a strong and aggressive, assertive Russia come in and, you know, either through proxies mm-hmm. or in hybrid ways, put down that emancipation. And then leads to greater assertiveness of Russia and Russian presence, especially mm-hmm. if the EU, as you mentioned, the EU probably in most cases would be much more on the declarative diplomacy side rather than any sort of active support. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very interesting also to think about it in this way, where one scenario could lead to the other scenario.
Exactly. I can only stress that these scenarios are not mutually exclusive. Mm. And first of all, there's no expectation necessarily of following every step within a scenario. But I think as you see and like talking through these scenarios, it provokes a response. No, it provokes thinking about what could happen. And then the next step is in a way coming up with policy responses, policy ideas. And that's the aim of the report, for us to have a conversation about the events, what can happen, what cannot happen, and then right. come up with solutions.
So let's talk about one event that is happening as we are as we speak, and that is the of course the COVID-19 coronavirus outbreak, which is affecting everybody, including the region of Eastern Partnership countries. I think that these scenarios that you outlined are still very valid, mm-hmm. even with this new factor and this new reality that we have. But I do want to ask, maybe just for your opinion and your take, how do you think that the pandemic could affect EU's relations with Eastern Europe, with Russia? And would any of these scenarios maybe be more or less unlikely or likely as a result of the crisis that we now face?
Well, I can start my answer by in a way linking your question a bit to what the European Commission has communicated last month. Now, if you look at this joint communication with the High Representative, there is a little reference there to COVID and sort of the element of a pandemic. But what you get is very much a sense of like, this is a baseline scenario. This is a scenario taking into account that nothing really will go wrong. And sort of in a status quo, this is sort of the policy proposals we have for the next 10 years or so, which we'd be very happy to fulfill. And it's in a way, it reads a little bit like a missed opportunity, even though I personally think it's good that communication emphasizes elements such as resilience, such as differentiation, which to some extent are either important because that's the reality, but also because it's important to prepare some of these countries to be more resilient, especially in a health-related crisis Damn. Like today. But then you still get the sense a little bit that this strategy, in a way, doesn't prepare the Eastern Partnership neither as a framework nor the six individual countries for events like these. I think on the one hand, it's positive from what I've seen in the last couple of days that the EU is willing to make available some additional funding to help the six countries. I think that's an important signal.
Yeah.
We've seen as well the sort of the risk of soft power being abused by more authoritarian states as sort of a global PR campaign to blemish the reputation. And I think it's definitely one of these situations where the EU cannot be absent, where it definitely clearly needs to communicate the efforts it's undertaking or already has undertaken in building capacity to deal with crises, whether they're health crises or other crises within those six countries.
Yeah, exactly. And I do want to point out that I had an op-ed which was published by you on Visegrad Insight. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Which we look at actually this case, looking at Eastern Europe, European Eastern Partnership, and how the European Union can and should support the efforts. And I think you are absolutely right that we see how public diplomacy or soft power methods are being used by countries like Russia or China to illustrate their solidarity with other countries that are being really hit, when in fact, I think that the EU should be doing even more. And I think, you know, the EU has a lot more resources to actually support these countries that need it. And you know, we have to recognize also that the infrastructure in a lot of these post-Soviet countries is very weak. Mm-hmm. And of course, the economic fallout, which is going to happen after this, you know, even if we manage the pandemic, the economic fallout is going to be very significant, and will have a strong impact also on the Eastern Partnership countries.
Yes, I agree. I mean, there's a lot of scope for action, and even if some of these measures are only going to have to be taken in sort of the aftermath when it comes to sort of economic recovery. In a way, the planning and the ideas about policy response already need to be happening right now. There needs to be thinking about these measures right now before it's too late.
Absolutely. Well, Quincy, thank you so much for joining us. And just a reminder to our listeners that the report is available at Visegrad's website, and it's titled Eastern European Futures, Scenarios for the Eastern Partnership 2030. Quincy, thanks again for being with us on Talk Eastern Europe.
Thank you for having me, Adam.
It was an interview with Quincy Clovert on a report on the future of Eastern Partnership. I hope you enjoyed this episode, because it's almost everything what we have prepared for you. In the end, we would like to ask you for any feedback and you usually give us, and we really appreciate that. So thank you for all your emails, thank you for your activity on our Facebook group. Also, I would like to ask for a 5-star rating on Apple app or whatever app you use to listen podcasts. And
much
else, Adam?
There's one more group of people we need to thank in particular, and of course that I'm talking about our patrons. And we are very grateful for them. If any of you listeners out there would like to support the podcast, you can donate as little as $2 a month and get or as much as $20 a month with certain benefits that do go with each level of donation. But one benefit that all donors get is a shout out on the podcast, and we want to say thank you to all of you, in particular William, Wilhelm, Urs, Steve, Stephanie, Sophia, Pierre, Pavel, Nicholas, Mark, Caitlin, Janusz, Jason, Ian, Eric, Elizabeth, Dennis, David, Bartek, and Anastasia. Your support is really, really appreciated, and it really helps us develop this podcast even more.
So, that's all what we have. Thank you very much for listening, and until next time.